Chapter 16. Strangers Here. What was lacking at the School of Economic Science was communication. At least, communication was one of the things that were lacking, albeit perhaps the most important. The teaching giving out at the classes was undoubtedly interesting and helpful, at times even stimulating. But there was no room for discussion, and Terry's soul panted for discussion as much as the psalmist's heart panted for the water brooks. He desperately wanted to be able to engage with a sympathetic friend or two in the kind of intellectual exchange of which the Platonic dialogues were the supreme example. Discussion, however, was something that the school frowned upon. Teaching was given very much ex cathedra, and students were not expected to ask questions or air doubts, or even to talk much among themselves during the coffee break. Communication, thus, was entirely one way, which meant that it was not communication at all in the full sense of the term, and it was not surprising that the tutors, as the class instructors were called, should have been, in Terry's opinion, rather too conscious of their position. He therefore was pleased when I asked him to come and see me one evening, and still more pleased to have the opportunity, when he took up the invitation shortly afterwards, of telling me his entire history. 2 days later came my lecture on Buddhism and mysticism, and our exchange about India. I had only been half serious when I asked him if he could drive me there, for I was undecided whether to go back that year or not. But an hour or two later, when we were in my room at the Vihara, he confirmed that he was ready to accompany me there. This time, too, he stayed until nearly midnight, and I confided to my diary, as before, had an extremely interesting exchange of thoughts. Find he brings out what is best and deepest in me. Thereafter, our friendship developed rapidly. Usually we met once or twice a week, more often than not after Terry had driven me back to the Vihara, either from a lecture at the College of Psychic Science, or a lecture or meditation class at the Buddhist Society. On one such occasion, being loath to stay indoors, we went out for a walk on Hampstead Heath, and despite 2 showers of rain, it was early July, sat on Parliament Hill talking and looking down at the lights of London, until somewhere a clock struck 12. We then drove to an Indian restaurant in West Hampstead, where Terry had a meal and I a coffee, after which he returned me to the Vihara, and I gave him a copy of the Sutra of Wei Lang. Most of our conversations were à deux, but whenever Vivian accompanied Terry to the Sunday afternoon lecture, as she occasionally did, they would both come up to my room afterwards, and one Sunday Terry was accompanied by his younger colleague, Alan, who wanted to meet me. Though I knew now that Vivian was Terry's girlfriend, I was not surprised that I had at first been uncertain whether she was his wife or his sister, for they behaved more like good friends than lovers, and it was obvious she had a life of her own apart from Terry, and did not expect him to spend all his evenings and weekends with her. What was more, she too was looking for a philosophy, and may have attended classes at the School of Economic Science for a while. She had certainly been given a mantra, either there or at the School of Meditation. Both organisations taught the so-called transcendental meditation introduced by the Maharishi Mahesh Yogi. And in the course of the next couple of years, she was to visit me independently of Terry a few times in order to discuss her practice. Though Terry still thought she lacked the capacity to be creative or original, and though there was no question of her being the ideal partner of his youthful dreams, the partner he once hoped Gillian would be, he remained fond of her in a detached sort of way, and was grateful for the companionship she had given him over the years. If Vivian was more like a friend than a lover, then Alan was more like a disciple than a colleague, at least outside office hours. An unsympathetic observer might even have described him as Terry's sidekick. Short and stocky, with a square, pallid face and dark hair, and an expression at once good-natured, earnest and puzzled. He evidently hero-worshipped Terry and hung on every word that fell from his lips. In his own way, he must have been looking for a philosophy, or at least something more than a career in advertising could give, but he had little capacity for abstract thought, and I noticed at both that and our few subsequent meetings that he received the scraps of Gurdjieff and Plato that Terry fed him from time to time, with the same mixture of awe and incomprehension with which the average ancient Greek must have received the pronouncements of the Delphic Oracle. I also noticed that Terry adopted towards Alan an attitude that was distinctly didactic, even a shade patronising, and that he was less open with him than he was with me or even Vivian. The truth was that Alan did not know Terry very well. He knew nothing of the unhappy childhood, the problems with Gillian, or the 2.5 years of psychoanalysis. Least of all did he know about Terry's ether experience or the effect this had had on him. In Alan's admiring eyes, Terry was a young man who, besides being remarkably well-versed in philosophy and psychology, had a good job in advertising, an account at the fashionable Berkeley Square branch of Lloyd's, an attractive girlfriend, a Volkswagen caravan the office had jocularly christened the Sex Wagon. Terry himself was known as Golden Balls on account of his supposed success with women, and a bachelor flat in NW3. Terry indeed was all that, but he was very much more. What Alan and others saw was only his persona, the mask he had learnt to don for social purposes, or in the more radical language of an author to whose writings we were to give a good deal of attention in days to come, only the character armour he had developed in order to protect himself, initially from his parents, but afterwards from a hostile world. Behind the persona, behind the armouring, there existed the lonely, frightened child who was forced to kill rabbits, the lover who had never experienced an erotic glow, the so-called schizophrenic, for whom the moment of total oblivion, the moment of seeing the pure white light, was also the moment of a return to a world which, in comparison with that, was hell, and the desperate seeker after a philosophy within whose context he could attempt to dispel the clouds that were obscuring the natural radiance of the mind. Looking at Terry's relaxed figure as we sat talking in my room and listening to his measured speech, it was difficult for me not to believe, as Alan and the others did, that the mask was the man, and that the history Terry had related to me on our first evening together was a tale of old, unhappy, far-off things that now belonged to the past. Only gradually did I come to realise, in the course of the months and years that followed, that the account he had given me was as much synchronic as diachronic, and that my friend's past was very much part of his present reality, indeed was steadily encroaching upon it. Even his experience of the pure white light, euphoric as it had been, had left him with an existential problem to solve. Though our conversations were interesting and worthwhile even with other people present, Terry and I found them most stimulating when there were only the two of us, which usually was the case. After these more intimate exchanges, my diary for the day would include such entries as felt very strong affinity, long talk until 2 o'clock in the morning, good quiet discussion for an hour, and deep mutual exchange. Apart from the one on Hampstead Heath, these early discussions all took place in my room at the Vihara in the evening, and they invariably lasted a long time. But stimulating though they were, and crucial to the development of our friendship, I have no recollection of their actual content, except I know we talked about some of the Gurdjieffian ideas Terry had acquired from the School of Economic Science, and about Timothy Leary's recently published The Psychedelic Experience, which was an updated version of the Bardos Adol, or Tibetan Book of the Dead, into which I had dipped at Terry's suggestion, and that I once spoke about the late, great Jamyang Khyentse Rinpoche, from whom I had received a number of Vajrayana initiations in 1958. My capacity for reproducing a conversation or discussion verbatim has always been limited, so it is not surprising that at a distance of more than 30 years, and with only a few laconic diary entries to help me, I should be able to give no more than a general idea of the kind of things Terry and I talked about at the time. Not that this really matters a great deal. What the two of us talked about was less important than the fact that we did talk, and that our talk was of such a kind as to bring us closer together, and this way to forward our friendship. The key to the nature of that friendship was perhaps to be found in the word affinity, which I had used in one of my diary entries, and in a dream I had a couple of months after Terry and I met. The affinity was a spiritual, even a transcendental one. Terry had seen the pure white light, and I, at the age of 17, had awoken to the truth of the teaching contained in the Diamond Sutra, described by Dr. Konza as one of the sublimest spiritual documents of mankind, and in the words of my earlier memoirs, had at once joyfully embraced it with an unqualified acceptance and assent. To me, the Diamond Sutra was not new. I had known it and believed it and realized it ages before, and the reading of the sutra, as it were, awoke me to the existence of something I had forgotten. Neither Terry nor I had been able to remain permanently on that higher level. Both of us had been forced to descend and devote ourselves to the task of what he called dispelling the clouds obscuring the pure light of the mind, and what I, more Buddhistically, thought of as self and world transformation in accordance with perfect vision. But though both had descended, it was as though we had descended on either side of a veil that was sufficiently transparent for us to be able to communicate with each other through it without too much difficulty. The dream, according to my diary, was both curious and impressive. I wrote, "I was seated round a table with a number of other people, as at last night's meeting. In front of me, on the table, there was a collection of jewels, of all sorts of beautiful shapes and colours. Apparently I had been away somewhere and had brought the jewels back with me. In the dream, I felt rather sad because no one was interested in the jewels or even wanted to look at them. Suddenly, my teacher, Dada Rinpoche, appeared on my left, smiling, and looked at the jewels, whereupon I felt happy and awoke. Jewels and objects made of jewels often figured in my dreams, and the beautiful ones about which I had dreamt the previous night were all the Buddhist teachings I had brought back to England with me from India, and which I was trying to communicate to the people attending my lectures and classes. No one appreciated those teachings at their true value, the dream seemed to be telling me. Between me and my auditors, too, there was a veil, but this veil was a thick and opaque one, through which it was difficult for me to make myself heard." The reference to the last night's meeting was a meeting of the Sangha Trust. The meeting had been a stormy one. Probably it was the one at which the Trust eventually decided, by a majority vote, to rescind its support for the London Buddhist College. And the fact that tempers had been lost and harsh words spoken must have disturbed me and left me with the impression that the Dharma was the last thing anyone really wanted to know about. Deep down, I must have felt that I was a stranger here, a metaphysical outsider. I had read Colin Wilson's famous book in Kalimpong, so that when I came across Hans Jonas's The Gnostic Religion some years later, I felt I was in familiar territory, and that I understood what had led the ancient Gnostics to formulate their doctrine, or create their myth, of the alien whose true home is elsewhere, and who sojourns on earth as in a foreign land. But if I was spiritually a stranger in my present environment, and an outsider, Terry was equally a stranger and an outsider in his. Inasmuch as we had both descended, we were in a similar predicament, and just as two exiles in the literal sense are overjoyed when they happen to meet and at once feel at home with each other, so Terry and I, recognising that we were both citizens of another realm, were able to communicate without too much difficulty and to develop, before many weeks had passed, a friendship such as neither of us had experienced previously. I did not feel that I had known Terry in a former earthly existence, nor did he entertain any such idea with regard to me. Our affinity was beyond time, so to speak, not within it. Neither did I feel that in Terry I had miraculously found my platonic, or rather Aristophanic, other half. I have never felt that way about anyone. Though Terry still hoped to find the ideal partner who would enable him to experience himself more fully and function more effectively. Not that he was actively in quest of her. He was only too happy, for the present, to concentrate on developing his friendship with me. That friendship soon was disembarrassed of any remnants of formality, due partly to his strict and repressive upbringing. Terry, in any case, tended to dislike formality, preferring that human relations should be conducted on an informal basis. This does not mean that he treated people casually, much less still that he took liberties with them, but only that he sought to relate to them simply as fellow human beings, rather than in accordance with their social or economic position. Me he never treated as a monk in the way the others did. The fact that I wore a yellow robe and was head of the English Sangha meant nothing to him. He even took to addressing me not as Bhante or Your Reverence, as everybody else did at the Vihara and the Buddhist Society, but by my Christian name, a fact that scandalized one or two good lay Buddhists when they came to know of it. I did not mind him addressing me in this way. Had he thought I minded, he certainly would not have done so, even though I had never liked my Christian name and had been glad when eventually it was superseded by a Buddhist monastic one. Indeed, I rejoiced that such a degree of intimacy and mutual confidence could exist between us, and that I was in contact with at least one person who was able to relate to me not as layman to monk, or even as disciple to master, but as friend to friend in the highest and fullest sense. We even talked of one day working together, though it was difficult for us to imagine what form this would actually take. Terry had his job and a 7-year-old daughter whom he saw every other weekend. I had the incumbency of the Hampstead Buddhist Vihara, as well as my work in India, especially among the newly converted ex-untouchable Buddhists. For the time being, therefore, we collaborated just intellectually and spiritually, by way of our late-night discussions, and did what we could for each other in small practical ways. Terry was particularly anxious to be of service to me as a designer and as the driver of a Volkswagen caravan, and towards the end of July I was able to afford him the opportunity of functioning in both these capacities. The publishers of A Survey of Buddhism had written a few weeks earlier informing me that they were planning to bring out a third edition of the work, printing double the number of copies, and inquiring if I wanted to write a new preface or make any corrections. When I told Terry this, he at once volunteered to design a new dust jacket for the book. I therefore let the publishers know that I would be sending them not only a new preface and a list of corrections, but the draft design of a new cover too, a professional designer who was attending my lectures in London having agreed to do the work for nothing. When we had decided, after a good deal of discussion, that the cover should feature not the Buddha's whole form, as the old one did, but simply his face, Terry and I went to see Claire Mason, who, I recollected, possessed a fine, rather mysterious-looking image of Sino-Japanese provenance. Terry thought the image would photograph well. Claire had no objection to him keeping it at his flat for a couple of days. The publishers signified their approval of the draft design he soon produced, and a year or so later, the third edition of the survey came out. Not everyone liked the black and red cover with its simple white lettering, but Terry and I liked it, and my friend was pleased that his skills as a designer had been of use to me. despite having been out of England for 20 years. Since my return, I'd done very little in the way of sightseeing. I'd been to Hampton Court and had taken a young Indian visitor, the son of my old friend Dr. Mehta of Bombay, to see the Tower of London, and that was about all. When Terry one day asked me if there was any place in England I particularly wanted to see and offered to drive me there in his Volkswagen one weekend, I naturally jumped at the opportunity of seeing a little more of my native land. But was there a place I particularly wanted to see? There were so many places I had not seen that I would have liked to see. In the end, I decided on Stonehenge. I had not seen the famous megalithic monument before. It was less than 100 miles from London, and if I was to start contacting my roots, then a growing preoccupation in some quarters, it was surely the best place for me to begin. One Friday evening, therefore, towards the end of July, we took the M4 to Windsor, and thence headed for the southwest. It was the first time Terry and I had travelled outside London together. I usually left town only when I had a lecture to give or a class to take at one of the provincial Buddhist groups. But on this occasion there was no lecture to give, no class to take, and I felt freer than I had done for a long time. Probably Terry too felt free. He was certainly glad to be driving not just from one part of London to another through heavy traffic, but from one part of the kingdom to another, along an open road on which it was possible to maintain a decent average speed. He was also glad that there lay ahead of us several hours of uninterrupted discussion, and lost no time coming up with one of his usual philosophical questions. This led to a small disagreement, the first we had ever had. With me, it was axiomatic that a driver should keep his eyes on the road, especially when driving at speed, and that it was impossible to drive safely and carry on a serious conversation at one at the same time. Terry, however, thought otherwise. Two quite separate areas of the brain were involved, he explained, and in any case, he had been driving since the age of 16 and had never had an accident. Though not entirely satisfied by these arguments, I allowed myself to be convinced. Later, I came to have complete faith in Terry's ability to keep his eyes on the road and carry on a serious conversation. And for the remainder of our journey, the time passed all the more quickly for our being deep in discussion. It was 10:30 when we reached Stonehenge. To my astonishment, it was surrounded by a barbed wire fence. I had not realised that vandalism was a problem, up against which several cars were parked. We parked alongside, and in the light of the headlights, were able to see the grey shapes of the stones. Probably because they were some distance away, and because there was no object beside them, no human figures, no tree, by which to estimate their real dimensions, they looked disappointingly small and rather forlorn, huddled together there in the middle of the desolate Wiltshire plain, like so many fallen titans. The following morning, I woke early, while it was still dark, and as soon as dawn broke, sat up and looked out of the window at the stones. I looked at them on and off for an hour or more, and when Terry eventually woke, he looked at them too. There had been rain the previous evening, but now it was wonderfully bright and clear, without a cloud in the blue sky, and the venerable stones, as they stood bathed in the early morning sunshine, appeared more gold than grey. The gate did not open until 9:30. We therefore had time for a walk, after which Terry prepared breakfast, for the little bus, as he called the Volkswagen, was of the dormobile type, and besides being capable of sleeping four persons, contained a miniature kitchen and sundry other conveniences. Once inside the fence, we wandered in and out among the gigantic stones, some of which were fallen or broken, and Terry took photographs. Most impressive of all were the three trilithons, 20 or more feet in height, which stood within what remained of the great outer circle of stone uprights. Chauvinistic Indian friends, mostly upper-class Hindus, had been fond of pointing out that India was highly civilized at a time when Britain was still sunk in barbarism. But as I looked around me that bright Saturday morning and reflected on the skill and knowledge that must have gone into the shaping and positioning of these enormous sarsens more than 4,000 years ago, I found it difficult to believe that the builders of Stonehenge had been quite such barbarians as my Indian friends supposed. As the place was aswarm with visitors, some clambering over such stones as were fallen or in fragments, evidently the weekend was not the best time to see the monument. We did not stay long at Stonehenge, but drove back to Salisbury, through which we had passed the previous night. According to my diary, I thought Salisbury Cathedral the most beautiful cathedral I had yet seen, by which I probably meant that I thought it more beautiful than either Norwich Cathedral or Chichester Cathedral, these being the two episcopal seats with which I was then most familiar. But, beautiful as its cathedral was, we did not stay long in Salisbury either, and having left the city behind us, we managed to find our way to a delightful spot by the river. Here we lay for more than an hour in the sun, and here, having slept for a while, Terry made tea and we had lunch. We also had an exceptionally deep exchange, perhaps our deepest so far, as I wrote in my diary. But regarding the nature of that exchange, my diary, once again, is silent. Perhaps I was contacting my roots in more senses than one. On our arrival back at the Vihara, Terry telephoned his friend Ivan. As I already knew, Ivan was infatuated to the point of obsession with a young woman colleague of theirs, who, unfortunately for Ivan, refused to have anything to do with him, and Terry was concerned for his friend's mental balance. The news was not good. Ivan had attempted to commit suicide, and Terry spent the best part of an hour talking to him and trying to persuade him not to repeat the attempt. He then signalled to me to take over from him as he needed a break. I had not met Ivan, but Terry told him who I was and that I would like to talk to him. The minute I took over, I felt I was struggling with the powers of evil. He was determined to commit suicide, Ivan said. But it was not what he said that horrified me so much as the way he said it. He sounded desperate, possessed. I had the impression I was talking not to a human being, but to a demonic entity, which, thanks to the state of intense, overwhelming craving into which Ivan had allowed himself to fall, had been able to enter into him and was now speaking through his lips. After Terry had talked to Ivan a second time, there seemed to be an improvement in his condition, and he said he might call back before 12. Terry therefore went to sleep in my armchair while I told my beads, but the telephone remained silent, and at 12 o'clock Terry went home, though not before we had arranged that I should let him know if Ivan called back. 15 minutes after he had left, the telephone rang. It was Ivan with a message for Terry. I passed the message on, and at 2 o'clock my friend telephoned to tell me he had just finished talking to Ivan and hoped that everything would now be all right. At noon the next day, when I was making notes for my Sunday lecture, Terry telephoned again, this time with the news that Ivan had committed suicide. He had gassed himself, apparently, during the night. I was not surprised, though I had not expected the sad and shocking event to happen so soon. A few hours later, Terry came to see me, and we discussed Ivan's death, and arranged to visit the Brighton Buddhist group together the following evening. Terry also told me that he had broken the news of Ivan's death to Nikki, the girl at the centre of the tragedy, and had brought her along to the Vihara with him to hear me speak. The lecture dealt with the arising of the will to enlightenment, and was the third in the series The Meaning of Conversion in Buddhism. Nikki sat in the front row with Terry and Vivian, a dark-haired, white-faced figure in black, that was probably not mourning. After the lecture, Terry took her home, and I did not see her again.